Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. This morning, we're going to chat about food. Yeah, food. It's in our lives every day. New science out of UC Davis shows the dairy and beef industries can drastically cut down their greenhouse gas emissions by adding a supplement to the feed. We'll speak to the scientists behind that. Also, the 2021 list is out regarding which produce items have the most and least amounts of pesticide residue. And the Sacramento Bee recently published its breakdown of the area's top 50 restaurants. Some are bargain bites and others are high-end, but they're all delicious, and we'll get into that. But first, as the farm-to-fork capital, we are often reminded that our meals start in the fields with farm workers doing the heavy labor. They're a critical part of getting food onto our tables each and every day. Data from the past year has shown this group has suffered disproportionately from COVID-19, and while there has been talk about prioritizing farm workers in the vaccination line, how are those plans actually working out? Well, Liz Crampton is an agriculture and food policy reporter for Politico Pro and joins us today to help us understand where California's farm worker vaccination rates now stand and how we're doing as a nation. Liz, welcome to Insight. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so what is the latest in California on the efforts to vaccinate farm workers?
You know, it's an ongoing process. You know, after a slow start when California opened up eligibility for farm workers, there are some bumps. You know, it was rocky at the beginning like it was in a lot of states. But in the last few weeks, a strategy has fallen into place that has shown some success. And what that looks like is farm worker organizations such as United Farm Workers have partnered with community health centers and farmers to set up pop-up vaccination sites in farming communities.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday, Democratic Representative Josh Harder, who serves the Modesto area, which is a huge farm area, said he was upset by a recent CDC report that placed California 44th among 48 surveyed states in the distribution of vaccines to counties with the most socially vulnerable residents, and that would include farm workers. In your reporting, is California lagging in this area?
In terms of overall vaccines, you know, California has a long way to go. But when you compare California's vaccination effort for farm workers to other states, it's actually fairly well positioned. I mean, in Florida, which has a large farm worker population, most workers are not eligible yet because that state is basing eligibility based off age. And as we know, most farm workers don't fit into that threshold yet. They tend to be much younger. So comparatively, California is doing okay, but that's not to say that there's still plenty of room for improvement. And there's still, you know, estimated hundreds of more vaccines that need to be rolled out to reach the workers.
Yeah, let's talk about some of the other big farm states and how the nation is doing, and is there federal policy on it? But let's start with some of the other states.
Well, we've seen in the last few weeks, states are starting to open up eligibility for farm workers. You know, it took a long time for that to happen. Washington, which is a state with a large tree, fruit, and nut industry, they just started vaccinating last week. But in other states, particularly across the South and the Southeast, farm workers are still waiting. Florida, Georgia, and, you know, time is of the essence here. There's a lot of urgency in this situation because harvest season is coming up. In harvest season, the conditions are very conducive to the spread of the virus, as we saw last year. So there's a lot of urgency to get farm workers vaccinated quickly before they're going to be out in fields harvesting and packing our nation's fruits and vegetables.
Yeah, and I guess harvest depends on what the crop is. It goes year-round in some cases here in California, but there's certainly a surge of harvest that comes as we warm up, and that's straight ahead. Where is the federal government on this issue? Has it been entirely left up to the states as to when farm workers would get vaccinated, should they choose?
States are still, you know, in charge of deciding eligibility, but the Agriculture Department has started to get involved with the effort. They've been deploying its own veterinarians across the country to help administer vaccines. They have been looking and identifying storage facilities that could store vaccines. And Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack has indicated that they've been communicating with farm groups to you know, make sure farmers understand the importance of getting their workforce vaccinated.
When it comes to California's Central Valley, you mentioned that the United Farm Workers and the Cesar Chavez Foundation have coordinated with these pop-up events with a goal, of course, to vaccinate thousands of farm workers at these clinics. Are those expected to ramp up in the coming weeks, or are we at sort of the peak level for those?
Yeah, they're mostly being held on the weekends throughout March and into April during hours when farm workers can be vaccinated, so off work hours. And yes, they've proven to be successful in getting the word out and making sure that, you know, transportation is arranged for these workers so that they can get there. And the effort is expected to continue.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Liz Crampton, an ag and food policy reporter with Politico Pro, about the push to get farm workers vaccinated in the U.S. What about the rate at which farm workers are willing to take the vaccine? I understand there are some organizations in California that have launched bilingual public health campaigns.
That's right. Educational campaigns have been a big part of this because there were, there is some hesitation in these communities about getting the vaccine. And so that's why farm worker groups have been trying to be proactive in making sure that these workers understand the vaccine is safe and that it's available. And in places where farm workers are not yet eligible, groups are being really proactive in making sure that when it is time for them to receive the vaccine, they are ready to go. Farm workers want to get it and are able to.
Yet it sounds like farm workers do want to get it. Anna Ibarra reported for Cal Matters a couple of weeks ago that nearly 3 in 4 farm workers said they would get the COVID-19 vaccine as soon as possible. But of course, you know, vaccination clinics at farm work sites at that point anyway were still infrequent and reliant on scarce supply. How has the supply element of this changed?
I mean, as we've seen in every state, as more vaccines become approved and available, you know, supply is outpacing demand soon. So it's just about making sure that the vaccine is being routed to these communities so that they have just as much access as other more urban settings.
And in terms of routing it to these communities, there is a push in lobbying the California governor's office to make this happen?
That's right. Farm groups are using their political influence to try to convince the state government to have a vaccine allotment specifically for farm workers, just like the state has done for teachers.
Mm-hmm. Anna's reporting also said that large employers like Foster Farms, Palm Wonderful, reporting roughly a 90% vaccination rate in recent on-site worker vaccination clinics. That's according to Fresno County Public Health Department. That sounds really impressive, 9 in 10. Do you know at all through your reporting, is that the case with smaller farmers?
I mean, it's a matter of resources. Bigger operations are able to get vaccines in larger amounts, but we've seen a lot of producers being really involved in this. You know, they want to get their workers vaccinated because, you know, they want to protect their workforce and continue their operations. So there is a lot of advocacy on the farmer side as this as well.
Yeah. Liz, what's the level of optimism out there? I mean, if we go back to last summer, there wasn't a lot. And then as we moved into December and January, when the vaccine, when not the vaccine, but the virus was peaking in ways we hadn't seen yet, once again, these communities were among the hardest hit. Has that changed?
I mean, as we see more and more workers get vaccinated, of course, people are feeling more optimistic. But, you know, there's a lot of hard work ahead to make sure that these shots get into arms and that this workforce, which is essential and has continued to feed the nation throughout the pandemic, despite these staggeringly high rates of infection, are protected and kept safe.
Is it surprising that our food supply didn't just come to a crashing halt during all of this? I mean, especially here in California, where we supply, depending on how you look at the figures, but roughly 50% of the nation's fresh fruits and vegetables. When you've got a large chunk of your workforce either sick or in fear of getting sick, that could have come crashing down, yet it didn't.
Right. It is pretty remarkable that we avoided, any major food shortages. There was a few weeks last, April when people were stockpiling food, that grocery shelves were a little more bare. But, we've had no major food shortages in this country throughout the pandemic, and that's a testament to the resiliency of our food supply chain.
Yeah. Well, Liz Crampton is an agriculture and food policy reporter for Politico Pro. Thank you so much for joining us with your reporting today on this really important topic of vaccinating farm workers in California and the rest of the United States.
Happy to be here.
Up next, cow burping and out the other end as well. We'll discuss new science related to all of that methane, a potent greenhouse gas byproduct of the beef and dairy industries. Shoot us an email today if you have food questions, insight@capradio.org, or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. And you're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White. We're back in just a moment. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and our big conversation today revolves around food. In a moment, we'll discuss which fruits and vegetables in the produce department at the grocery store might carry the most and least amount of pesticide residue, helping you decide whether the organic upgrade is worth the cost. But first, we want to dive into new research out of UC Davis that could dramatically help curb greenhouse gas emissions created by the beef and dairy industries. Cows emit a lot of methane. How bad is methane? Well, here's science journalist David Pogue of CBS Sunday Morning here on Insight just last month.
Oh my gosh. One cow burps out 12 gallons of methane an hour. Methane is kind of like carbon dioxide, but right, 80 times worse. One cow. How about this for a statistic? One-third of the planet's non-ice surface is cattle-grazing land. One-third! Wow. That's why they're burning down the forests in Brazil, to make more cattle-grazing land. So after that, I just couldn't bear to eat beef. It's just like a ridiculous use of resources.
Well, after David made that statement, we heard from listener Ari in Stockton, who pushed back against those facts and recommended checking with UC Davis on the matter. So when the university last week released a new study about this very topic, I thought, perfect, let's have him on. Dr. Ermias Kebriab is a professor and associate dean of the UC Davis Department of Animal Science and joins us today to help us understand, well, the science of methane and cows and how new research could help with the problem. Doctor, great to have you here. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we appreciate it. So how accurate was David Pogue's statements about methane in cows based on your research?
Well, I think it depends where you are, because this is really, if you look at the global perspective, about 14.5% of the global greenhouse gas emissions come from livestock. But if you're talking about the U.S., it's only 4%. So only 4% of greenhouse gas emissions come from livestock. So a lot of it is, of course, from methane, because methane, again, it depends on what time frame you're talking about. If it is over 100 period of time, it's maybe 28 times more damaging. If it is over 20 years, about 80 times. But there's a big difference between methane and carbon dioxide, because methane actually gets destroyed in the environment after about 12 years, while carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere for hundreds, if not thousands of years.
So carbon dioxide is not as potent, but it's around a lot longer to do the damage. Methane
exactly.
is very potent, but it's here for a relatively short period of time, a little longer than a decade. But it's pretty powerful while it's here.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. And that's why we wanted to reduce the amount of methane that's in the atmosphere right now.
Mm-hmm. And how about his comment about cutting down the forests to make way for cattle grazing land? That's accurate?
Well, in some parts of the world, like in Brazil and sometimes in Argentina as well, forests are being cut down to mainly grow soybeans. So the soybean market is huge, and a lot of soybeans is exported to Europe. We don't really import soybean because we have a lot of soybeans in the US. Mm. So that's the motivation. The primary motivation is to grow soybeans. And then once that's when the soil is not really good enough for that, then cattle are grazed on those lands.
It's transitioned into cattle grazing land. When we talk about the cattle industry worldwide, there are roughly a billion, with a B, billion cattle out there?
Yes, absolutely. Between 1 billion to 1.5 billion is the estimate.
Uh-huh. And each one of those, burping mostly, right? But I guess some of it comes out the back end as well. Most people think it's all about the back end, but explain to us why it's really more of a burping thing.
Sure. So the methane is actually formed in the gut of the animal. So the gut of the animal, that's where the microbes are. And the microbes are the ones that are actually responsible for making the methane. And what the cow is trying to do is to get rid of the gas that's been accumulated inside their gut. And so that's why you see there's a lot of methane coming out of the front end of the mouth. So in terms of burping of the methane instead of coming from the other end. So I would say about 95-97% of the methane is burping out.
Wow.
While about 3% from the other end.
Yeah. Okay. And so you at UC Davis have come up with what could be a solution to reduce a lot of that methane that's coming out the mouth of the cows there. And it's to add seaweed to the feed. Talk a little bit about that. Is it a very specific type of seaweed?
Yes. So the seaweed that actually works to reduce methane emissions is called Asparagopsis taxiformis. This is a red seaweed. And the reason it does that is because it contains a special ingredients in its cells called bromoform and other halogenated compounds, and those basically interfere with the production of the methane in the gut, and that's why we see a reduction of methane. So unfortunately, not every seaweed works well, but this specific red seaweed does a tremendous job.
And do you need much of it? Now, you had a study that came out a couple of years ago, was it 2019, on this topic. How has this new study changed? It changed based on how much seaweed is given to the cows?
Yeah, so the first study that we did, we used a slightly different species, which was not as potent. So we had to give them a higher amount of the seaweed. But in this case, we used the most potent one, and we were able to reduce the amount we give them to about 1 to 3 ounces of the seaweed a day. And then the other thing that we wanted to know was that if you give them for a long period of time, would the microbes adjust, and would we have any issue in terms of adaptation of the microbes and making the seaweed ineffective? So we did this study, a longer term of study, for about 21 weeks. And then within the 21 weeks, we did not see any problems in adaptation.
Because one of the problems with the first study was that you reduced the amount of methane by a lot, but you also reduced how much milk the dairy cows were giving. So I can't imagine farmers would be too hot on that.
Exactly. So what happened was that as any animal, even humans, you know, when you present them with something that you have not really used to eat before, they didn't like it very much. So when you go up to 1% of their diet, they were reducing their feed intake and also the milk production. But in this case, the one we did now, the highest dose we went to was about only 0.5%. And that helped us to avoid the intake issue. So animals were happily eating the seaweed, and we did not have any issue in terms of production. In fact, we had a better feed efficiency conversion with the seaweed.
Hmm. Is there enough of this seaweed to go around with 1.5 billion cattle out there, up to 1.5 billion cattle around the world? Is there enough, or could we ramp up to enough seaweed to add this supplement so that all of the cows are sort of on this restricted methane diet?
Well, right now, there's actually been a lot of work that's been done to try to scale up this production, because this seaweed has not been used for anything before this, before we use it to reduce methane emissions. So there is a sort of a learning curve that's happening right now to try to figure out is biology. So the Scripps Institute for Oceanography are doing this right now. And also a couple of companies like Blue Ocean Barns, for example, are actively growing this the seaweed and trying to understand how we can grow it at scale.
Who's the person that came up with the idea and said, you know what, I think seaweed would work? Was it entirely based on the fact that knowing what the seaweed is comprised of added to the equation and it was like, oh, well, we need this and it's available in seaweed, so let's try that?
Well, actually, it came from an observation from a farmer in the eastern part of Canada, where he saw his cows grazing on seaweed, and those that were grazing on seaweed seemed to do better. So he approached a scientist, and they decided to do a screening of different type of seaweed, and they found that this Asparagopsis seems to do well in the lab. And then we thought, well, you know, if it's doing this in the lab, and we looked at the mode of action, we thought that it might do well in real animals as well. So we tried this in real animals a couple of years ago, and then again last year.
We're speaking with Dr. Hermias Kebriab. He's a professor and associate dean of the UC Davis Department of Animal Sciences about adding seaweed to the diet of both dairy cows and beef cattle in order to reduce the amount of greenhouse gas they emit, methane, which is very potent, but for a shorter period of time. What is the difference between dairy and beef cattle when it comes to methane production? Anything?
There's nothing, there's no difference really. The main difference is that dairy cows consume twice, 2.5 times more than beef cattle, mainly because they produce a lot of milk. Apart from their intake, their gut system is the same, so there's no difference between them.
Mm-hmm. And I know the feed that you give cattle can change the taste of the beef. Does seaweed change the taste of the beef at all in this case?
We tried that. We actually had 112 people as a panelist to try and taste the meat that was made from cows that was given seaweed, and those who did not give seaweed, and there was no significant difference at all. So there's no difference in taste, in juiciness, in meat quality. So it all appeared to be the same.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that farmers could actually save money by adding this supplement to their feed.
Yes. So the feed efficiency gain that we've seen was quite large enough. We have about 20% better efficiency of conversion. So which means that for the same amount of feed, they're going to be getting more animal products. So they will definitely be able to save some money for the feed, which is the biggest cost in a farm.
Is any of this beef or dairy available now to consumers?
No, not at the moment, no, because the seaweed needs to be approved by FDA before it can be used to feed and to reduce methane emissions.
How do you foresee this being a labeling issue? Like, for instance, right now, you know, when you buy your milk or you buy your beef, it's organic or grass-fed. You know, do you see this as something that could potentially drive sales? People, you know, who are green-minded and not wanting to purchase something that, you know, creates a lot of greenhouse gases might gravitate toward this.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of the things I would see is that some retailers might want to show what is the carbon emission associated with a certain product. I mean, this is already happening in Europe. And I'll see it happening here as well, and say, you know, this product has been produced, with much less carbon emissions. There has been a campaign, for example, from Burger King, what's called the Cool Whopper, where you could, you know, promoting this kind of work so that you can have beef burgers or animal source products with a much reduced carbon emissions.
Yeah, Burger King was one of the first to bring on the Impossible Burger as well with that same sort of thought process. How far out do you see this the process taking with approval from, you know, that it could be used as feed and then it getting to market?
I'm hoping that the approval to be used as feed would be in about a year or so, and then to be used for reduction of methane probably about 3 to 4 years is my estimate.
We talked about taste, but is there any health benefit to the humans eating it? Does it change the nutritional value of ground beef or milk?
I don't think it does. So we looked at the nutritional value also of meat. We actually have a new paper coming out soon. And there was no difference in terms of what is in the beef, and looking at the fat content, the protein content, and all that was not significantly different.
All right. Dr. Hermias Kebriab is a professor and associate dean of the UC Davis Department of Animal Sciences. Thank you so much for joining us today with this research, and good luck with it heading forward.
Thank you.
Okay, let's move from the beef and dairy department at the supermarket to the produce aisle. For the past decade or so, I have relied on a couple of lists put out annually that help me decide whether I should buy a specific item as organic or whether conventional can do in any given case. One list is called the Dirty Dozen, and it represents those produce items that have the highest levels of pesticide residue or chemical impact to the environment. And the other is called the Clean 15, and it represents those that may be okay to buy the cheaper conventional version. Doctors Alexis Temkin and Thomas Galligan helped put these lists together and are with the Environmental Working Group, the organization that puts them out. Welcome to Insight to both of you. Nice to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And Dr. Temkin, I'm going to get to you in just a moment when we start discussing citrus. I do notice that citrus does not appear on either list, so I want to dig into that with you. But I'm going to start with Dr. Galligan. Why does EWG, Environmental Working Group, create its shopper's guide to pesticides like this?
Sure. So based on USDA data, so our guide, these rankings that you're talking about are based on USDA testing data. So based on that data, nearly 70% of produce in the US is contaminated with pesticide residues. So each year, EWG updates these lists based on the most recent USDA data so that we can help shoppers make the best, healthiest decisions when they're shopping in the produce aisle.
Yeah, and one thing that has stood out to me for a really long time are strawberries. They're number one on the Dirty Dozen list for 2021, and that has been the case for years. They're a huge crop in California, the fifth largest ag crop, third if you only count produce, because dairy and beef that we just spoke about are in front of them. But if you're just talking about produce, that's huge to be California's third largest produce crop. What is it about strawberries that keeps landing them at or near the top of the list?
Well, there's a couple things worth noting. So the first is that the USDA doesn't test each product, each crop every year. They pick a subset. So the most recent testing data that we have for strawberries is actually from 2016. But despite that, the growing practices tend to remain relatively stable year to year. So even though it's relatively old data, we have no reason to think that strawberries would be any better this year than they were in 2016. So in terms of why strawberries are kind of always on the list, you know, it could be a number of things. That they're grown close to the ground, and, you know, perhaps they're more porous, so they retain pesticides better. You know, this is all conjecture. We don't look exactly at why each crop is where they are in the ranking. We look at the data and decide, we rank them based on the numbers that we get from the USDA.
Does it matter at all the type of pesticide residue that's there? There's so many different, ways to keep the pests away. Some are potentially more dangerous than others.
Sure. Yeah. So the USDA tests for hundreds of different pesticides. And many of these pesticides have been linked to things like cancer and hormone disruption and harm to developing children and their brains. So we consider all of those in our rankings.
Okay. So number two on the list is spinach, followed by number three, kale. Greens are a big crop on the central coast of California, nectarines, apples. And then coming in number six is grapes, another huge crop for California. Does it matter the type of grape, whether it's a wine grape or a table grape?
I would assume that the USDA in this case is focused on table grapes, but we did do some looking into raisins last year. So raisins were tested in 2018 by USDA, and raisins had a shockingly high amount of pesticides on them.
Following grapes is cherries, peaches, a couple of stone fruits there, pears, number nine. Number 10 is bell or hot peppers. 11 is celery. And number 12, another huge California crop, tomatoes. Is there anything specific about tomatoes you can point out for us?
No, nothing immediately comes to mind. There's another one that's sort of a perennial dirty guy on our dirty dozen list.
Yeah. So in each one of these cases, in the dirty dozen, you would recommend buying organic or some sort of farming method that doesn't use pesticides.
Yeah. So EWG does recommend that you choose organic whenever possible. But part of the reason that we make this list is we know that organic foods are not always accessible or affordable to everybody. And so we use this list to help shoppers sort of set their priorities. So for these 12 on the Dirty Dozen, focus on buying those organic whenever you can. Mm-hmm. And if you can't afford organic, then you can turn to our Clean 15 list. Those are conventional items that are relatively low in pesticides despite not being organic.
Yeah.
But I think the other important thing to note is that it's important to eat lots of fresh fruits and vegetables, no matter what, whether conventional or organic. You shouldn't be skipping fruits and veggies because you're concerned about pesticides. Just if you can, choose organic or choose our Clean 15.
That's a really good point to make. And the residue levels are considered within the safe range, correct?
They are considered within the legal range, which doesn't necessarily mean that they are safe. So the way that the federal government sets limits on pesticides, we think that there's a lot of room for improvement there, particularly for helping protect children from the harms of pesticides.
When it comes to this residue that's on the produce, can consumers wash it off? Does that help reduce the levels?
So that's a great question. So the USDA does process the food before they test them. So for example, if a consumer would wash it at home, then the USDA washes it. Or if they would peel it like a banana, then they peel it. So the numbers that they report, the levels that they report, are a good indication of what consumers would actually be eating at home after washing. So unfortunately, washing alone is not going to reduce your pesticide exposure.
I see. All right, let's get to the Clean 15. And at the top of the list is a huge California favorite, avocados. Interestingly on this one is that avocados are also one of the top purchased organic items. So even though people are gravitating toward organic avocados, they top the Clean 15 list.
Yeah, well, buying organic isn't just about reducing your own pesticide exposure. Buying organic also sort of sends a message that you support agricultural practices that are better for the environment, better for farm workers. So even though avocados are on the Clean 15, it's still potentially worth considering buying organic again whenever possible.
I see. And so to continue on the list here, we've got sweet corn, number 2, a pineapple, number 3, onions, number 4, papaya, 5, and then number 6 is sweet peas, but frozen. Why is there a difference between frozen and non-frozen on this item?
That, I believe, is just a reflection of the specific product that the USDA tested. I don't know if they actually tested fresh sweet peas. So they only tested frozen. So we include that distinction there.
Probably the majority of peas purchased are of the frozen variety anyhow. Eggplant, right. Number 7. And then a really large crop for our San Joaquin County listeners, asparagus, which... That's terrific because asparagus tends to be pricey to begin with. So if you can go with the conventional version, I guess it helps out there, right?
Absolutely.
This one surprised me. Number 9 is broccoli. I don't know why. I assumed broccoli would have ended up in the Dirty Dozen, but it's on the Clean 15.
Yep. Again, we don't have a great idea of the, you know, the exact practices that might cause one to be on one list versus the other. But yeah, broccoli's at number 9 on the Clean 15.
Okay, well, Dr. Thomas Galligan, thank you so much. Dr. Alexis Temkin, I want to loop you in now. I do notice that on these lists, citrus does not appear. So I want to dig into that with you. What types of pesticides are found on citrus? Is it a crop that relies heavily on pesticides?
Yeah, so citrus, if you're looking at sort of our typical rankings for the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15, we actually look at 46 different crops. And so there's a whole bunch of them that kind of just fall out in this middle area. And citrus being tangerines, grapefruits, and oranges are some examples of those. And so one of our six methodology points in terms of when we look at this list for ranking is what percentage of the crops actually have at least one pesticide. And citrus fall pretty high in that ranking. So they're going to have in the 90s to almost 100% have at least one pesticide. And that typically tends to be a fungicide called a mazaleal. And that fungicide in particular has been classified as a likely carcinogen by EPA and has also been linked to endocrine disruption. So it's a particularly toxic pesticide that we're kind of highlighting citrus because there is such a high percentage of detection frequencies.
But yet it's not on the Dirty Dozen list. But yet
exactly, because we also consider some other elements for Dirty Dozen, such as how what percentage have two or more, how much of the actual pesticide is on fruits and vegetables, how many pesticides in general are used. So for citrus, you may only have like 5 to 10 pesticides used on the crop. For peppers, for instance, which are on the Dirty Dozen, you have up to 115. So there can be a pretty big spread. And that's why we use multiple ways of sort of slicing the data to get to our ultimate list.
Mm-hmm. The amount of pesticides used with citrus, has that changed over time?
So this is kind of interesting. As I was mentioning, there's fungicides are the main type of pesticide used on citrus, and that's actually used once the fruit has been picked and you are using it post-harvest is what this is called. So it basically prevents the fruit from rotting or growing any mold while it's sort of sitting on the shelves, right, waiting to be enjoyed by consumers. And what we've also seen is that there can be an increase in fungicide resistance. So if you look at testing data from USDA from 2011 or 2012, there were about 3 fungicides used on the crop. In recent data from 2019 and some of our testing for, from 2020, there's more like 5. So you're actually seeing an increase in the different types of fungicides that are required and the percentage that have maybe more than one fungicide on a sample.
And as we spoke a little bit with Dr. Galligan about what can consumers do to reduce their pesticide exposure, citrus has a skin, so is just peeling it off enough?
Yeah, so to go back to that, the way USDA tests and actually the way so EWG did our own testing for some of these samples, we peeled the citrus and sent in just the edible portion of the crop. So the fungicide is reaching sort of the inner layer that you would eat. So peeling isn't the only, won't necessarily help. That being said, if you eat the rind or are using, you know, like a zest of something, that's probably going to have higher levels and is worth considering. But similar to the Dirty Dozen and other recommendations, organic samples are going to be a good option to really reduce pesticide and fungicide exposure. The other thing that was interesting with our data and some samples from USDA was that tangerines that were imported had higher levels of a mazaleal. So you could potentially choose a domestic sample that, you know, won't be free of pesticide or have a really low level the way organic might, but it might be lower than an imported sample.
Oh, good to know, especially being in a citrus state. Doctors Alexis Temkin, thank you so much for being here. And Thomas Galligan, appreciate your insight on this as well.
Thank you so much.
And they're with the Environmental Working Group, the group that puts out the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15. Still ahead, looking for a place to grab a bite to eat later today? You'll want to stick around because Sacramento Bee food reporter Benji Eagle is here to run down his top 50 restaurants list with us and give us a sense of how the industry is doing at this stage of the pandemic. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and today we are chatting about food. Over the past several decades, Americans were shifting to relying on more foods prepared outside the home. In fact, in 2010, according to the USDA, for the first time ever, more than half of the money spent on food by Americans was for food away from home. And the numbers continued to rise from there. That was until the pandemic hit. Restaurants, of course, took a huge hit when COVID-19 lockdowns were issued. But many stuck in there, surviving on patio seating and to-go orders. Now, with some lockdowns easing and vaccinations rising, the industry is at a pivotal point. Food and beverage reporter at the Sacramento Bee, Benji Eagle, joins us today with some thoughts on where the industry stands. And he's also here to share notes on the paper's new top 50 restaurants, or 50-ish restaurants in the Sacramento region list, one he helped put together with dining critic Kate Washington. Benji, good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so how did you go about narrowing down, identifying the Sacramento region's top 50-ish restaurants?
Yeah, it was a big pull because, you know, there's about 2,000 restaurants in the Sacramento region. We're talking Yolo County, Sacramento County, Placer County, in El Dorado County for the purposes of this list. And some of them Kate and I had already eaten at, and we knew that we wanted to go back and give them a real review. Some of them we talked to people in the industry or, you know, friends whose taste buds we trusted and then went and checked it out for ourselves. And some of them, you know, we did a little research online, places that seemed to have really interesting menus or kind of an interesting backstory. And so we ended up eating at really just, you know, I think more than 100 restaurants in total to try and narrow it down to the top 50-ish that we came up with.
Yeah, and price range is all over the map, which I think is a really good element of this list. It's not prohibitive to people who are on an extreme budget, especially given the period of time that we're in. But there are some high-end ones there as well. Did you try to mix it up that way?
We did, yeah. You know, we really went for a lot of diversity in the list in terms of price, location, type of cuisine, because, you know, we want there to be something for everyone within there, something that everyone can afford to get to and enjoy eating. So yeah, that was intentional as we did our research.
Yeah. And it's mixed up also in terms of different traditional ethnic cuisines and that sort of thing. It's really all over the map. I got to commend you. One of my favorite restaurants is on there, Nick's Tacos in Placer County. I'm always confused when I get into that area, whether I'm in Rockland or in Roseville. I think it's in Roseville.
Yeah, that's right. In Roseville.
Yeah, it's great. It's really good. So I love to see it make the list like that. But while you have people like me who are excited to see places, undoubtedly you hear from people that say, why didn't my restaurant make the list or my favorite spot? How do you respond to that?
Sure. Well, you know, the first thing is to say that there's about 2,000 restaurants within the Sacramento region again, and we're picking the top 50. And so, you know, there's going to be a lot that are excluded, and that doesn't mean they're a bad restaurant by any means. That just means that, you know, we didn't include them in this one. The other thing to note is that we had hoped to publish this list initially in about May 2020. And we still had some restaurants to review by the time the pandemic rolled around. And we kind of hit pause on it for a while to see how long the pandemic would last. You know, initially we thought it might be a couple months or a couple weeks. And as time went on, it became clear that it was going to be a longer term project. And that's how we ended up with top 50-ish, because Kate and I only selected 42 restaurants, I believe. And then we asked readers to vote for the final eight that should make the cut. And some of them in particular, you know, got a lot of votes, which is, I think, a lot of readers saying this should have been on your list. This should have been one you were reviewing that we just didn't get to. So I think that's a model we might try and take into next year's list as well. I'll do a little fan voting, reader voting in there.
Yeah, because you've put out lists before that had some backlash. Was it a brunch list? I'm trying to remember. Trying to remember now. It was either a breakfast or a brunch one. And I remember, I wouldn't say you issued a correction, but there was a sort of a retooling of it, right?
There was a follow up. I just want to say that was not my list, but okay. I do remember it. That, you know, there were some notable exclusions and head scratching inclusions in there. And so there was kind of a second article about, hey, you know, maybe we missed a few spots.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So you mentioned that originally you wanted to put this out in May of 2020. But you hadn't hit all the places that you wanted to visit yet. Were there any places that you hadn't hit yet that didn't make it through the pandemic that are no longer open?
Let's see. I can't think of any places we didn't make it to that didn't make it through the pandemic, but there were some places that we had planned on including that we had eaten at that did not make it through the pandemic. One of them being Post Oak Barbecue out in the Arden Arcade area. I thought they did a really good job, and unfortunately they folded a few months into the pandemic.
In addition to the closing of places like the one you just pointed out, how did COVID-19 impact the list? Was any of it based on their to-go menus or patio seating?
In writing the list, we did try and update it with what they were doing as far as to-go or patio, or, you know, maybe some of them like Ella Dining Room Bar have been closed the entire pandemic. But we felt that it wasn't fair to judge one restaurant based on indoor dining pre-pandemic and another one on to-go or patio dining, you know, in the middle of the pandemic when they've had to lay off staff and, you know, reorganize how they're doing their business. And so when we were doing the reviews and deciding who to include and who not to, we really did go with a pre-pandemic dining model. And a lot of these places, you know, have made good pivots and we've been back to them, you know, during the pandemic, but that's kind of what we chose to stick with.
I love the concentration of Southeast Asian restaurants on the list there. Sacramento just has such a rich selection to choose from. That must have been hard to narrow down. Thai Farmhouse made the list, which I really like, so I was happy to see that.
Yeah, that was one that was, you know, tough to narrow down, but I think is really one of the best parts about eating in Sacramento, that you can just drive down Stockton Boulevard or, you know, another street in South Sacramento and pop into a place you've never been before. And odds are you're going to get a meal you're happy with. You might try something you haven't had before.
It's
a benefit to our city.
Expand your horizons. Benji, in the final minute here, give us a sense of where you see Sacramento's restaurant scene going. Would you consider it healthy at this point in the pandemic?
I think it's getting healthier. Restaurants across the U.S. just got, I think, $28 billion in President Biden's most recent stimulus plan. You know, they're starting to open up. Yolo County is going into orange tier perhaps this week, which would be 50% indoor occupancy. You know, restaurants all across the region can serve customers indoors. I talked to one bartender the other day who said that, you know, he feels like the places that have made it this far are going to be okay. Mm-hmm. So hopefully he's right.
Yeah, let's hope so. Food and beverage reporter at the Sacramento Bee, Benji Eagle. Wow. Thanks for joining us today. We appreciate you being here.
Thanks for having me.
And as always, that's Insight for today. But you can learn more about our guests or what they were talking about at capradio.org/insight. Thank you to the producers, Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, and managing editor, Aram Sarkissian. I'm Randall White. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow when we discuss the path to reopening society, including challenges for some when it comes to returning to in-person learning or heading back to the workplace. What's going to happen with the dress codes? You'll want to hear that decision tomorrow on Insight. Make it a great day.